Hello, everybody. This is Coach Aaron Saft in the Running's Life podcast. I've got a somber episode today as a friend, a brother in ultra running, and just an amazing human spirit has left us. I'm referring to Hunt Brumby. And if you knew Hunt, he was an amazing guy and an amazing story. And this episode is a tribute to him. I usually don't re-release episodes, but I wanted to pay homage and tribute to my friend, and I felt this was a good way to do it. This was a conversation I had with Hunt after he finished the Ball State 500K. Excuse me. Hunt was one of my athletes. I knew him way before that. He ran the Fontan Dango. Was his first attempt at a pretty far distance, and Hunt wasn't a front of the pack. He wasn't a mid pack. He was a back of the pack guy, but his spirit was indomitable and he just could keep moving forward no matter what the circumstances. And he proved that in the Ball State 500K, just like you'll hear in this conversation. It's really hard and I'm getting emotional just thinking about it, just thinking about the fact that I won't hear his voice again. So, I'm not going to say anything more on this episode about anything else going on. As I said, this is all about Hunt and just my memory to him. My love goes out to his wife and his son, his remaining family. He left us too early. Hunt was my age, which makes it really tough to imagine someone leaving us that early in life. So I'm glad I got to say I love you, my friend, and wish you well as you journeyed forward. He faced cancer with courage. I hope we can all face our endings just like Hunt did. Strong-willed, loving every ounce of life, and just, you know, being there for everybody else until the end. He really did make a difference in a lot of people's lives. He inspired so many, and I think you'll hear why when I re-release this episode. So I hope you enjoy this and get a little piece of who Hunt Brumby was. And so until next week, I'll leave you with my conversation with Hunt.
I think we're both in the same boat of recovering from rather large expeditions.
we are. Congratulations, by the way. That was a wonderful, wonderful accomplishment of yours.
Well, obviously yours was magnified to the nth degree by completing the Vol State, man. And I can't wait to talk about that because, I don't want to spoil things, but when you first, you know, said, "Hey, can we do this?" I said, "Well, yeah, I know you can." And you're there was that question mark, like, you know, this may be outside of my comfort zone or even outside of something I can do, but you know, I had faith in you, so I'm so proud of you for doing it. We'll get to all of that. So, but let's start with you. Where do you come from? Where'd you grow up? All that good stuff.
Yeah, man. So, born in Georgia, but really spent most of my life in Western North Carolina, a small town called Murphy, North Carolina.
Yes, sir.
A little west of you. So, last town in Western North Carolina. grew up kind of small town playing sports. Football player. It was kind of what you did, Murphy. You either played football or you were really smart, and I'm not really smart, so I played football. Surprisingly, I did grow up in a running family. My father was a cross-country coach, actually coached a 4x800 junior Olympic gold medal team. Still ran college cross-country, full ride scholarship, and so even though I wasn't a runner, I was around it. So I always kind of had that you know, outside view looking in with running throughout my childhood. After I graduated high school, I joined the United States Marine Corps. I really wanted to leave Murphy, and I thought that was the best way to see the world. Nice. I didn't leave the South with the Marine Corps. I got in the Marines, and I was a Marine Corps Security Force Marine, and I had special duty. But that was the first time I really kind of started running. It was kind of a forced behavior, but I did run in the Marine Corps. We basically did a lot of stuff and timed it to about a 5K distance. I was really big going in the Marines, about 240 pounds, and they got me down to 180. And that's when kind of I was fast for, you know, for a Marine. I was about 18-minute 5K-er back then, and that was a long time. But that 1997. But I thought I'd never run again. I hated it because it was, you know, people sitting over my shoulder yelling at me, and I was running away from the yelling. But after the Marine Corps, I got out and I joined the Army National Guard while I was going to school because I thought, you know, they'll pay for my school. And where I never left the South with the Marine Corps, I ended up in Iraq with the National Guard.
Oh, wow.
I spent 2002, 2003, I was in the initial pushover, push through. And we, you know, we did our thing, but I was hurt in Iraq and I got sent home. And that's kind of where my first part of my journey began. I was kind of lost. When I came home, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, separated from the military, and spent a few years of kind of wandering around, wondering what I was going to do. And not just activity-wise, just in life in general. You come home, and the weird thing was that Iraq went on for so long in Afghanistan that, you know, I had, you know, a person who was 3 years old when I went over, served in the same war as I did. So not only was I coming home trying to readjust, I was watching it every day on the news. And, you know, so I had some years where it was tough. I became a truck driver and I liked it because it was solitude. But also the byproduct of that was I blew up to 330 pounds. Just lethargic, lazy. You know, the lifestyle is not conducive with being healthy. I quit that in 2007 at my father's request and came home again. And fast forward a little bit, I started one day I woke up and I said, I'm going to hike the Georgia section of the Appalachian Trail straight through, just the Georgia section. And granted, I was 330 pounds, but you have to understand when I looked in the mirror, I still saw a Marine. And so I set out to do that and I made it one day. And it was the worst feeling in the world. I broke down. I cried. It was just, I wasn't who I was. I've, you know, athletic growing up, a very accomplished Marine, very accomplished at my time in Iraq. And now I couldn't make it, you know, first day I went 8 miles and it broke me. But from then I knew that time off was a big thing. I was working. So I just Googled hiking, and for some reason trail running popped up. I don't know why, but it did. And there was a race in Helen, Georgia, Helen Holiday Half Marathon. And I said, I'm going to do this. And honestly, I went and did that. And I was training myself, if you call it that. I was just going out and trying to run. And I was running at 330 pounds. I was hurting my legs. And I never did a run over 4 miles. And I went and did that on less than 1 month of training. And that wasn't even a full half. It was supposed to be, but I think it comes in at about 12 miles. It took me 4 hours and 45 minutes. And I was the last person across the line. And they had already taken down the arch.
Oh.
It never broke me. I always thought, you know, I'm going to go on and do better, bigger, better things. So that's kind of a little bit about my lead up to running. It was kind of inspired by the military.
And I mean, even though, you know, you said last person across the line, when you first started that story, you smiled. And that was kind of the first time you smiled in that story.
Yeah.
What was in that smile?
Man, the last few years of, you know, I've been running 2.5 years now. You met me way early on when I limped across one of your finish lines. So I think you were calling back and like, hey, there's a guy out there with half his face tattooed. He may be dead on the trail.
I knew where you were.
Yeah. I'm easily identifiable. The smile is I found my tribe. You know, I think it's important. And I've grown that tribe. When I first started, it was, I found trail running and I stayed within that RDs and race directors and that groups of races. But what I quickly found was people weren't going to let me be what I was on my worst day. You know, when I talk about Iraq and the post-traumatic stress, and that still pops up, there's bad days, but my friends within the trail running community and the running community as a whole, they don't let that define me. They know the smile. They know that I'm a back of the pack ambassador. That's what I call it. I'm here to you across the finish line. And I just remember that day as a feeling of accomplishment where I failed on the Appalachian Trail. I crossed that finish line, and it was one of the first accomplishments I've done since being home from Iraq. I mean, other than like getting married and stuff, as far as personal.
Right.
It was just, there was no medal that I needed. There was nothing I could have, I was easily, you know, I could go through later in life and finish a race and podium. It'll never replace that feeling. Because I fought for it. I struggled for it. And I still crossed the finish line, no matter how bad I wanted to quit.
And so, obviously, you finished that, and you knew that wasn't it. But what did you think was next? Or what did you make next?
The next thing, my next, very next race was a 50K. You got to remember, and you met me in, I think, Fontanego was March.
Yes.
So, I did that half marathon in December.
Okay.
In January, I did the Cheeha Challenge, which is in Albany.
Okay.
It's a very flat 50K. Took me 11 and a half hours. Same thing, cross the finish line. And in March, I went from I did Fontanego.
Yep. So and we should probably give folks reference that you came from a completely flat 50K to Fontanego, which in the 50K is roughly about 6,000 feet of gain, with some good, you know, rugged trails and some good climbs in there.
Yeah, I still hate you. That was not a good idea, and I don't suggest it. you know, the thing about me is I've got a lot of grit, and I think that's important for anybody who comes into the ultra world. I always hear a saying that, it stopped being fun, so I stopped. Well, I'm here to tell you, it's always going to stop being fun. There's no way you can go out and run even a 5K at a hard pace and it be fun the whole time. The reward is what's fun. So I accepted early on that there was going to be times it was going to be awful, but I was going to keep moving. Yeah. Because I remembered what that finish line felt like at Helen, and I wanted that over and over. It never bothered me that I was last. In fact, my first five trail races, I finished dead last. And I was proud of that because statistically, that's almost impossible to do without falling out. I wasn't trying, without trying or falling out of a race. I made all the cuts, but I finished last. And I was very proud of that. But yeah, it was just even fun. I think so. Fontanego, for the people out there, it took me 15 hours. I remember you being at the finish line. I finished ahead of two people that were in the 50 miler. And I was so proud of that. That was, I really, Fontanego was when I really kind of felt like I had arrived in trail running. it was a battle and it was a hard course. And then I knew I kind of belonged somewhere within the community.
Absolutely. No. And, you know, there was a number of people that were waiting for you at the finish. You had already, you know, made enough friends in that short period of time that were waiting for you to finish. I mean, you know, from December till March, you know, they were done and, you know, just hanging out at the finish. They're like, Hunt's coming. And I was like, yep, he's coming.
At some point.
He's on a mile 8 hill, but he's coming.
I mean, that's the great thing about the community. And believe me, I'm nothing special. It's not that I came in with this magic formula and I made all these friends. It's that anybody can come into running or trail running and you're going to find this support and these people. I mean, one of the guys was Alex Brown, who was there. Yeah. And I believe Alex finished second that day. And Alex waited for me. Mm-hmm. And Alex made my race his own. you know, I remember the second lap when I finished, I wanted to quit. And Alex set me down, gave me a beer, and gave me some ramen. And when I stood up, he goes, "How you feel?" So I feel a little bit better. And he pushed me back out on the course. It's everybody. We in the trail running community, we adopt other people's races as more important than our own, because other people's successes is what builds the community. And we're not talking about just numbers, or we're not talking about trying to bring Nike or these big sponsors in. What we're talking about is stories like mine. We're talking about trying to bring in people to overcome their personal battles, or some people who just need to celebrate a success. We want to see that. And I think, to me, that's more important. I wish nobody, I would finish dead last in every race I ever did if it meant nobody fell out of a race.
Totally. And I would debate that, you know, you're not special. I mean, to every race director, you know, everyone in that race is special if they're doing what they're doing out of passion and love. And I think everybody that is in that race feels the same way about everybody else, because when they come upon somebody, "Are you okay? Do you need anything?" It is very rare that I ever see or hear somebody, you know, come by, or, you know, hear a story that that person's just a jerk. You know,
no, it's rare.
It is rare. It is a very caring community. And, you know, we're brothers and sisters to one another, because we all share in one common goal, and that's reaching that finish line. So I think we're all special to one another. And I think to the RDs, I think everybody in that race is someone very special, and we care that you make it to the finish line. That's our ultimate goal for the runners. So, you know, to say you're not special, I think you were more special because I got to know you a lot longer.
Yeah. No, believe me, I get my money's worth out of every race.
And it's fantastic, because that's what we're there for. We're there for those stories. And I think that's what inspires more people. You know, like, we always hear the story of, let's just take Hard Rock for his example. We always hear the stories of the Francois Dehaene. You know, all of these podcasts are trying to get these big names, the Dylan Bowman, the Sabrina Stanleys. But like, I don't find as much inspiration in their stories unless there's something that they've truly overcome. When I hear the stories of, you know, the people that are mid back of the pack, those are the stories that I want to hear. I want to hear about their perseverance. What made them persevere that hard? And you know, I think that's what's great about you, and especially with Vol State. That's the story I really want to hear, because that's the ultimate story of perseverance. You know, so far as running goes, obviously. We've talked about Fontanedengo. You finished the 50K. Let's talk, you know, in your development, you've obviously done a few, I think, 24-hour events as well, right? Like,
I've done you, I've done a Black Toe Run out of Tennessee, hill course. I've done, Alabama Trap Trail. I did 12 hour. I really gravitate towards the timed races. I think they kind of reward, if you go into the 24 hour, it kind of rewards grit, because you can move slower at the start, but kind of inch your way up. And I tend to finish mid pack in those. Whereas a straight trail race, I finish back of the pack. So I like the timed races a lot.
What's been the longest distance to date? Aside from Ball State, I'm sorry.
Aside from Ball State, I did 100K. I went to last year, the Seven Trails Festival, the opening year of Jason Green's race. And it was a 36 hour, basically anywhere, as much as you could run up to 100 miles. I went out there, and I think I stayed on the course for right at 20 hours, and I finished my first 100K. Nice. And that was my longest distance race to date. I also have done Tunnel Hill 50 miler. And finished Tunnel Hill 50. Actually, the same year that I did Fontanedengo, I moved up. That first year was crazy. I over-raced. I think I raced like 17 times that first year. Ultra sign-up owes me money. But it was just kind of, I had that bug, and it was just like, how far can I go? How far can I go? And I still believe that. Like, that's still my motivation. It's like, how far can I go? I just want to do it smarter and with a better training plan in place to help, you know. Grit gets you so far, but, you know, proper training is that thing that pushes you over the top.
Yeah. and we seem to have found a good balance, you know, so far as running and walking goes. Now your job now requires a lot of walking. It seems like we found quite the balance leading you up to Vol State. You know, obviously we kept you healthy going into Vol State. Vol State was a totally different story, but we could talk about that. But let's talk about what was the impetus. What was the backstory? Like, where did you find Vol State and why did that become your focus?
Okay, so there's two parts to this. The first part is the where I found out about Ball State was I was at a race with Greg Armstrong was there running. It was a timed race. I'd basically heard about Ball State from a podcast in the past where they had guests on who did it. But Greg had run it, and I kind of picked his brain about it. And he looks at me halfway through it, and he goes, "You should do it." And I was like, it kind of the first time anybody who looked at me and was like, "You should do it." And I laughed. He goes, "No, you would make it." He's like, "You should do it. It's life changing." So I sat and talked with Greg about it. The other thing is when I was, before I was even running, I read a book and, Walk Across America. I don't know. By Jenkins. And, it changed my life just because it wasn't about racing. It wasn't about running, but it was about his experience of walking across America back in, I think, the 70s. And he, just the people he met and how he really got to know people from the country. And I wanted a little bit about that. And the more I learned about Ball State, the more I knew that was as big a part of it as the race itself. And I really wanted to be a part of that. So that's where I kind of got the bug for it. Initially, I thought it was going to be, and that was 2 years ago, you know, last year. And initially, I thought it was probably going to be 4 or 5 years out before I did it. And I kind of just, every year, I kind of, let's say, have some cocktails and I sign up for the wait list. I wait till it's over and then I put myself on the wait list late. And thinking, you'll never get in. Well, this year I got an email. I think it was March. I think we got that email. And they said, we're sorry to inform you. We regret that you accepted the Ball State. You know how Laz does. And that's when I immediately got a hold of you because I was looking for you to say, don't do it. And you did. You know, I still remember that I texted you and I said, what would happen if I tried to hike 314 miles? And your response was, I don't know. Let's see. I was looking for you to go, we're training for 100, Hunt. Don't do this. No, you pushed me into it. So I hit accept at that point. And I will say this, from the moment I hit accept, not finishing was never on the table. There was two ways I wasn't going to finish that race. One was they were going to have to call medically and have me pulled off the course because of an ambulance. The other, they were going to pull up in what they call the meat wagon or the van and say, you're going too slow, get in. But I was not going to personally quit. And that in itself is what turned into the battle that I had at Ball State.
Nice. Now, Ball State, for those that don't know what Ball State is, can you just describe what the distance is, what is the course, et cetera? Can you just give us that background? Yeah.
So Ball State is a journey run. I think Laz doesn't even like to refer to it as a race. It's officially a race, but it's a journey run. It starts at Hickman Landing in Missouri. You get on a ferry, you cross the Mississippi, and you're in Kentucky. And it ends in Castle Rock, Georgia. So officially, you run through five states. It's 314 miles or 500 kilometers or kilometers. So It's a long run. You get up to 10 days. Officially, there's no real cutoff, but basically you're required to cover a 50K a day for 10 days, and that would get you in at the bare minimum. So that's the bare minimum. They have what they call So you go through Kentucky, which is a very short run, I think 10 or 12 miles. Then you go into Tennessee, which the majority of the race is in Tennessee. It starts in northwestern Tennessee. Kind of goes down southeast through the whole race and then cuts east hard. you end up in kind of that area in the Chattanooga, Georgia area, Alabama area. That's where Castle Rock is. So through Kimball, Tennessee, and then you'll hit Alabama for a mile or so, and then to Georgia. So officially you set foot in 5 states during this race.
Nice. That's cool.
Yeah.
How does directions work?
So you can print off, believe me, this race is not very big on giving you handouts of how to do it. You are required to go on the website and pull the turn by turns off if you need them. So you can print. I printed all the directions onto one sheet of paper and put it in my pack. Also had a GPX file with turn by turn that I loaded on my phone. And that's what I used the majority of the time. I never had to really refer to the paper directions. There was only at the start, there's a lot of turns, but then you get into these where it's like 20 something mile stretches of the same road. It's not for anybody who wouldn't do this race because they're afraid of getting lost. Don't be. It's a very easy. I did it first year and I was able to follow. I never once got lost. There's a lot of veterans on the course who have it just memorized. And I mean, so the first day or two, I was able to hook up with some and keep with them. But as I found myself alone, I just followed the directions on my phone.
And talk about supported versus unsupported, which Laz terms something else.
So it's crude versus screwed. And, you know, I'm good because I get to talk about both of these because I started out in the screwed division, or meant self-supported. And as it got towards the end of the race, I had some friends who finished and they came back and asked, hey, do you want support? And they asked, and I said, yes, because the most important thing to me was the finish. So you can do it in the crew division, which means you've got help. You've got a crew. They can ride in a car. They can pull up ahead. The only requirements are that they not stop on the road. They have to pull off the road completely, but they can have your food ready. You can sleep in their vehicle. The vehicle cannot move you. So they can't drive you to a hotel or anything. So, but they can, you can have a, you know, they can hand you water bottles every mile if that's the case. You're self-supported, you're on your own. You're supporting, looking for gas station foods, gas stations to be open. You're looking for Dollar Generals, which are the gold mines along the way. And there's also Road Angels. This race has been going on so long. The one thing I will say is while they build this as not having aid stations, that's a little misleading in the fact that about every 10 miles, there was somebody set up at their house or on the just left a cooler on the road. But a lot of people, they had signs that said, Ball Staters sleep on the front porch, you know, Ball Staters come and rest. And it was, that's really what the race became to me, is it became a journey of learning how good people really are.
That's awesome. That's so cool. We talked kind of before you started about like mental and framing it in a, you know, in a positive way. Cause you had mentioned, you know, just based on past and how you've dealt with ultras in the past that you have to go dark sometimes.
Yeah.
What'd you find in this one?
So exact opposite. I'm so glad this is the first time. In the past I've kind of fed on like Iraq, and in Iraq, if you were out, you had to get back, because believe me, there was nothing good about getting stuck out in the middle of a city at night, you know, so there was no choice, but there was some bad things that happened to me over there. So sometimes in a 50K, I would put myself there and it would just cause me to go dark, but keep me moving. Well, this race was way too big for that. If I go dark on day one, there's 7 to 9 more days of I can't be in that mindset. What I found here was I was overwhelmed by the goodness of people. For those who don't know, I'm very tattooed up to my face. I've got 50% of my face tattooed. If you didn't know me, I'm probably your stereotypical biker looking guy. And I was very concerned about that because this goes through small town country Tennessee. And I thought, well, these people may be nice, but they're not going to be nice to me, or they're going to be apprehensive of me, or I'm going to have trouble with the police. What I found was that when given the chance, people are just generally good. You know, there's always the exception, but for the most part, people pulled over every day and gave me water, or gave me food. And they didn't know about the race. They just saw a guy on the road who was probably thought I was hitchhiking. And they stopped and they gave me food. I had people offer me rides. I had people who weren't set up as road angels who yelled at me during a rainstorm to get on their porch. So that took me to a very positive place I've never experienced before, that my heart was just filled with the joy of, like, man, if you put all our, we get so caught up in social media and everything, but just on a day-to-day, given the chance, these people are really good.
Absolutely. And so I would encourage folks to, you know, find your social media, your Facebook especially, because you did a lot of Facebook Lives. And you can talk about those, because, you know, you were, I could tell you were in a good frame of mind by watching your Facebook Lives, and what was coming out of your mouth was, you know, just positivity and the exuberance that you felt for those that you had met. So if you want to just touch on, you know, what prompted you to start doing all of those?
Yeah. So actually I made the conscious decision. I said, the one thing before the race, I said, the one thing I will not let this race break my smile. It can break a lot of things. It may break my soul. It may break my spirit, but it will not break my smile. And I said, you know, I'm a rookie. So how are these people going to remember me? And the one thing I decided on was they'll remember me as the guy who smiles. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the one thing you learn in a race like this is pain is not an emotion. Pain is a byproduct of an emotion or a controller of emotions. But you can be in an extremely happy mood and be in a lot of pain. And I dealt with that a lot during this race. So, yeah, during this race, I just said, every person I meet, I'm going to smile and I'm going to be extremely positive. If they say, how are you doing, Hunt? I'm going to say, I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing? You're doing great. You know, listen, we're having a wonderful, how great is this that we get to choose to put ourselves in this discomfort? We acknowledge it as discomfort, but nobody's forcing us. We're not being forced on this march. We're not being forced to go through this. We chose to put ourselves into this discomfort. And then when we get done, we get to go back home to our comfort. So we are living a wonderful life. And every person I met, and it kind of called on, like, I started seeing comments like, how come he's smiling in every picture? And it's almost like he should be broke by now, but he's not. And so I kind of became that guy that I smile, and I still do. Like at work, when I go to my job, you know, I'm a supervisor, and no matter how bad the night is, I smile. You know, we've got to be happy. That's a bare minimum. We can be happy and still deal with the discomforts of life, or the every once in a while, the depression, or, you know, the day, but, you know, we still can find a reason to smile.
That's great. It was tremendous. Just to watch your Facebook Live videos, and, you know, I would check in, of course, you know, text you, just kind of, you know, see how you're holding up. Just wanted to make sure you're still moving and okay. I was, you know, I saw the reports. You can talk about what was bothering you if you'd like, because, you know, go right ahead.
All right, so we started, and day one was great. Day one, I put down 45 miles, and it was by design. So the first 12 hours, I did a 50K, or right at 30 miles. I did 30 miles, and that was great because that did my 24-hour total almost. The second 12 hours, I hit a bunch of rain, and but I still got 15 miles in that night. I also took a nap I laid down for 2 hours, but probably slept 30 minutes of it. The second day, we were going along, and we had stopped for lunch, and I felt a big pull in my shin, almost like a really bad shin splint. And I thought, well, I'll work it out. I'll just keep moving. And it got worse as the day went on. And I got to a point where we were in Pine City, and I had to make the call to stop and go into a hotel. And I was separating from a group that I had hooked up with, and I hated it, but I was limping. I mean, it was bad limping. And so I went into the hotel. I remember making a promise to you that I wouldn't make any decision among the race on the empty stomach or at the very low point. So I said, I'm going to go sleep for 4 hours. I went into the hotel, I slept for 4 hours, got something to eat. I woke up and I said, I'm going to make a push, but today's the day. If at the end of the day, I'm not moving, I'm not going to keep going and quit on day seven. So it's either going to be quit day three or make it all the way. And so I moved that night, and it was a limp. So I would limp for 2 to 3 miles. I would get going. To give people an idea of my speed, 22 minutes was a fast mile. Some of the miles hit 30-minute range. If you go back, anybody who's Strava friends with me, I've got it loaded. It's like 50 different runs. But you can look at my mileage times, and they're not like what you would think. But 22-minute miles felt fast. They felt like 8, 9-minute miles. I just kept moving. I got into a place. I was right up against what they call Oprah, which is the cutoff. But that kind of was a blessing. That broke my race down into 12-hour segments. I knew at the end of that 12 hours, I had to be ahead. And my shin continually got worse, and I continuously kept moving. And afterwards, you know, I'm still dealing with it a little bit, but it's gotten a lot better. So I don't think it was a shin splint, but more of a tendon issue.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, you fought through that. That was pretty incredible. I mean, pictures of you with ice bags.
3 or 4 times a day. So my routine would be is in the morning, I would ice my feet, which is extremely painful for anybody who's just stuck their feet on ice, especially after they've been pounded. I would buy a bag of ice and I would stick my feet on it. I'd also stick a bag on my shin. I would have to do that 3 to 5 times a day just to keep moving. And what I was doing was numbing my shin, numbing my feet so I could keep moving. The big savior for my feet was day three. My friends from Nashville, that's when day four, I decided to go crewed at that point. And the reason being, I hadn't yet picked up a crew to help me, but my friends from Nashville said, we'll come down and fix your feet. And it's Becca Jones and John Cox. And they came down, drove all the way from Nashville, and they pulled over on the side of the road. They set me down, brought me Dairy Queen, and they just worked on my feet, which God bless anybody who touches feet after that many, you know, miles. And I didn't have a lot of blisters, but I had some, and they just basically massaged my feet out, fixed what I had, brought me fresh socks, and it was a rejuvenation. And my shin, though, never got better. It was just basically I had to put it out of my head. But around day three, which I think is around when you hit Tracy City, it just kind of became the norm. My body accepted what I was doing. Day three and four, my body said, okay, it's still going to hurt, but we know we're not going to stop. And it's amazing what your body will do if you just ask it to do it. So I kept putting down 22 to 26 minute miles and just kept it going. And believe me, there's nothing more painful than running / walking that slow for 314 miles. You feel every step. I would look down at my watch and it would say like, you know, I'd be on my run and it'd say like 1.6 miles. And I'd be like, okay, I've got 3 miles to the next, you know, stop. And I, you know, it seemed like 30 minutes went by. I'd look down and it'd say 1.8 miles. It would literally, my mind was so gone that what felt like forever, and I'd go 0.2 miles. So it took a lot of mental stamina. And I use the word stamina. In toughness, anybody who joins that race has toughness. But stamina just took it to put up with that for that many days.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and you're going this long, you know, both distance and in time, normal gels aren't just going to cut it, man. So talk a little bit about, like, you know, what did you do to sustain calories?
Yeah. So the first part of the race, I was, like I said, when I was doing it self-supported, gas station food became my friend. Now, remembering coming up on the weekends when we would do our long run hikes, I would purposely eat gas station food. I wanted to prepare my stomach. The big things for it became calories over taste. My favorite staples were chocolate milk, 240 calories, and you could down them quick, easy on your stomach. So when I stopped, what I would usually do is get two Gatorades and a chocolate milk, and then I would eat a candy bar of my choice, and then I would buy three Payday bars because they don't melt. And I would put the Payday bars, man, they're 240 calories apiece, and I would put them in my pack. Now, there was plenty of times I probably became calorie deficient on this, but I wasn't moving fast enough where it affected me the same way it would in a 50K. I did carry a bladder for water, and I always tried to have two Gatorades in my pack. Now, the one thing to remember is my pack probably was 25 pounds total with food, water, and everything. So this is not a carry a little pack. This is you're carrying some weight.
What pack did you use, by the way?
I used a Ultimate Direction FKT. And it's 20 liter. So really worked out well. Didn't have any rubbing, didn't have anything. My only concern was at the start, the bottom belt, you know, I'm a big guy. I started the race 235 pounds, which is much better than the 330 I was a few years ago. But I started to, the bottom belt didn't want to snap without being tight. I can tell you at the end of the race, I couldn't keep my shorts on. And that's not like an exaggeration. I was literally had to tie something to keep my shorts up, and they were drawstring.
That's awesome.
So I don't know how many calories I was burning today. I was eating. When I became crude, my diet totally changed. I would go 2 to 3 miles and I would stop, and my crew was putting pizza in me, Doritos, chocolate milk. I was probably eating, once I became crude, I was probably eating 6,000 calories a day. And I lost 21 pounds during the race.
Wow, man. Jeez, that's insane. What was the best meal? What was the thing that, like, you know?
Oh, easy, man. Easy. Sonic.
Oh, yeah.
we came into, and excuse me for not remembering exact towns, but it's first time. So I came into a town, I don't think, maybe Jasper, and there was a Sonic open, and I went and had two double bacon cheeseburgers, a large tater tot, a large Coke, and a large 44-ounce cherry limeade. And I ate that in, like, 4 minutes. Like, literally, I ate that meal, and on the way out of town, I was eating Payday candy bars. But it was so good. You don't know. Like, I stopped, and those double bacon cheeseburgers, the salty and savory, and, oh, man, I wanted to cry. Like, you know how they have the quotes at the end? It's like, yeah. Mine was all about food. It was like, they picked the quotes just from the conversation you had, and they were asking me, and I was like, and one of the things I said was, it's been a long time since I cried in front of strangers. But that Twinkie was good, and it was deserved tears. That was not a lie. I cried once when somebody gave me some Twinkies, and it was so good. I sat there and tears involuntarily ran down my face. It was so good. I was just like, this is so processed and so perfect.
So processed and so perfect. The two P's. Oh, my God. That's tremendous. I love it. Oh my gosh. I think mine in Hard Rock, we went into this aid station, and for some reason it was just the way they did it. They crumbled the bacon into the eggs. And that was my moment. I had been presented it in many different ways over the course of Hard Rock, but just having crumbled bacon in the eggs, it just, oh my God. Like, I was like, can I have another one of those, please? That was wonderful.
That is awesome. No, that makes the biggest difference. Like, I limped into that town. And I will say, like, while I was eating that meal, I didn't remember my shin. And I didn't care about the fact that I was getting ready to go into one of the I didn't know at the time, but I went into one of the worst hallucination nights of my trip. Just awful. We had to climb this pass, I guess. It seemed like a pass at night. But it was a climb. And I started hallucinating hard, and I'm not used to that because I hadn't gone deep a lot. And so hallucinating on highways is a iffy point.
Yeah. And were they, I mean, were they abstract enough that you knew they were hallucinations, or did they?
Yes. Well, yes and no. So I was climbing this pass at night, and I was just tired beyond belief. Like, I think I was doing 35-minute miles, but I had to keep moving. And it was a four-lane. It was four lanes, and I had shoulder, which is good. But I was going up, and there was big rocks on the side. Like, as you got higher, there was big rocks. And one of the things I saw was, like, a missile sticking out of the top of the rock. And I said, well, that's from your military. You're thinking about missiles. But one thing that was dangerous was I kept hallucinating benches in the road.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sit down, but I was able to go. Nobody would put a bench in the road. Now, one time I did sit in the road, and I had to immediately go get up. Oh, now, the one thing I did hallucinate, and I knew it was wrong, is Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum, huh?
Yes, greatest hallucination ever. He kept, I would see him, and he was at the top of the hill, and he was talking to me. And now, he hunt. Was, now, yeah, I can't do the voice, but he was like, you're moving slow. And I would get close to him, and he'd be up. And I, he's what got me up to the top hill. But the one thing I'll say is when I got to the top, it turned into two-lane windy going down.
Okay.
And I was like, I can't. It's dark. I'm because every step I would take, I was doing the stumble steps where you take a step and I would take two steps to the left and three steps to the right. And I was all over the road. So I did have to make the conscious decision when I got to the top of there to sit down on the side of the road and take a nap.
Good. Good. Yeah. Mine in Hard Rock were like noticeably stupid, you know, like it became like a joke, you know, like I saw like there was a, like a river and I, you know, pointed with my pacer. I said, hey, look, bumper cars, you know, like it, he knew it was like, all right, man, just keep moving forward. You know, just, we knew it was stupid, but it was comical. Like I would say what I'm seeing, you know, and I knew that there's no possible way that we're, you know, in this rural mountains and there's bumper cars, you know, so it was almost comical.
No, I'm just happy I finally had them. Like I've gone this long without. I was like, I really, like right, all the thing I didn't want was snakes. I was like, please don't be snakes. Please don't be snakes.
Right. Yeah. No.
And even then you got tricked because it's the highway and you would see snakes, like mostly dead, but you would see them. So every piece of rubber from a tire looked like a snake. And there was, and they warned me that this would happen. And it happened was you would step on one. And because there's radial sticking out, it would snap up and hit you in the shin. Oh, and you would think I got bit by, and sure enough, they called it a road snake. Yeah. It happened to me and I screamed. Yeah. Not very tough.
I mean, all of us have that fear, you know, like you're running the trail and you just hit a stick and you're like, oh, I got bit, you know. Yeah,
no, I mean, especially after your last experience, I can only imagine.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, you know, that, yeah, that one was, I mean, for, it took a while for no stick to look like a snake ever again. But, you know, I definitely out there, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't as worried about the live, you know, the animals out there as much. I mean, it was more all like marmots and those pikas and stuff. So it wasn't anything too bad, but. You're moving through, I think where are we now in the race where, you know, you're hallucinating? What day are we on now?
Day four or five.
Okay. So hallucinations are already starting at day four and five. Did you get some sleep after that?
I did. Now the thing about sleep in Ball State is if you stop, you're in so much pain, sleep at like eight, like road angel places, usually they'd have cots or something, and you would get, I would lay down for 2 hours. Now that's what I would lay down for. I would sleep maybe an hour. If I went to a hotel, I would stop for 4 to 5 hours, and that would involve showering. I did a hotel 3 times.
Okay.
And that would involve showering, icing, and sleep for maybe 3 hours. Of that, I would sleep an hour and a half to 2 hours. I think during the whole nine days plus, I slept 5 hours in 9 days.
Oh my gosh.
At the end we were doing an hour. Like I would do is because I was so close to cutoff that I would run for 12 plus hours and then they would put me down for an hour and then I would run for 12 plus hours and they put me down for an hour. So,
man, that's crazy. And so, you know, you got your crew, and now you've got kind of a sleep plan. They're feeding you. So you're moving. How did the mileage start to break up? Cause you know, I imagine you can't conquer as many big chunks at a time.
So what we did was, like I said, at this point, I never fell behind cutoff. That's one thing I'm very proud of, but I never pulled way ahead other than the first day. So at this point, I was within 4 miles of the official cutoff. That's how they do it by mileage. And it was 4 miles ahead of cutoff. And so we just broke it down into 12-hour races. I knew I had to cover X amount of miles, 31 miles, so 16 miles every 12 hours, which sounds easy, but until you're 5 days into a run, it's not. So they would just set me down and we would look at what's coming up. At this point, we were getting close to Summit. We were in the rolling part of Tennessee, getting ready to go into some of the climbs. It was just basically, I would break down. I would say, okay, I got to cover 16 miles before I can even think about sleeping, but we want to get some bank. So at 16 miles, they say, okay, you're good. Give me one more mile. That goes in the bank. Within that, we were going about 2 to 3 miles before I would stop and rest. So every 2 to 3 miles, they were pulling a chair out, giving me 5 minutes. And they were feeding me. Like I said, I'd stop and it was a piece of pizza in my mouth or a bag of Doritos or candy bar. It was something. Every 3 miles, they were keeping me. So once I became crewed, it kind of went on autopilot, the races. I didn't have to think as much. I just had to run. So going back next year, my goal is to finish unsupported so I can have that experience. But, yeah, so it was – when it became tough was a mile 270, we came into Mount Eagle. And Mount Eagle is in between Chattanooga and Nashville. And that was a tough climb. That was about 3 miles of climbing. But that's where we also found something extremely surprising was I had climbing legs. the fastest miles I put down during the race were on both the climbs.
Nice.
Yeah. So like all of a sudden I was just like, I don't want to do this. There was no shoulder on Mount Eagle. So you're literally, I did it at night, but you're climbing. If a car comes at you, you've got to jump in a ditch, a step down, like, or against a rock. And it's not safe. So I was like, I'm just going to do this as fast as possible. Yeah. So my crew went ahead. I climbed. I got up there and I saw my crew's car, but I knocked on the window. They were asleep and they're like, whoa, not expecting you for 30 minutes. I was like, no, I can climb. So I did that and it was amazing. I really wish, it's fun to say, I wish there would have been more hills at the end. I would have finished faster.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I think the other thing we'd probably be remiss not to talk about is the heat. This race is known for the heat. Can you talk about what it was like during the days?
Yeah, so I will say this year was one of the more milder years, but we had a couple days. I looked down and I think real feel was like 105. I think it was 90 something degrees with a real feel of 105. It's just a state of misery that's hard to describe, but you kind of got two choices. There's no turning on the AC, so you either just move or you just get suffocated by it and it ruins your race. I think the big thing for me was the fact that I was being positive and I never let it break through that, but I just slowed down. Daytime miles were extremely slow. Nighttime miles were where you made up ground. A lot of times I would do, I'd do 15 or so miles during the day. And I'd do 20 at night. And that's how I stayed ahead. For most of the days, the temperatures, if it didn't rain, were in the mid 90s with a real feel of about 8 to 10 degrees higher. Nighttime was 70 something to 80 degrees.
Did you have any type of cooling with your crew? Did they do anything to help, like ice bandanas or anything like that?
Towards the end of the race, I did pull an ice bandana. We did ice a lot for the most part. Now, one thing that really helped was, like I said, I carried a bladder. It was insulated. So every time we'd go by a gas station or with my crew, I would fill that with ice, even though I had a crew, and that would keep my back completely cool. Even though I didn't have to carry that water, I still did. And that was a big deal. The one piece of advice I'll have, especially anybody who does journey runs or multi-day hikes or anything like that, is your core temperature should be it's as important, if not more important, than your nutrition and everything. Because if you get too hot, there's no bringing it back. It's you're done for at least 4 to 8 hours.
Right.
Yeah. It's not a good thing to be. And I saw people who were overheated.
Right on. Did you do anything to protect yourself from the sun? Because, I mean, there are stretches out there.
I did. Yeah. So I did. I ordered a umbrella, a UV umbrella, actually a hiking. It's carbon fiber, you know, the whole deal. And it was, a $38 umbrella. But the umbrella helps a lot because the next to last day, there's a stretch called the meat grinder. And it's basically 21 miles of pure open road. It goes into it goes into Tracy City, which is right before Kimball and all that. And it's pure. There's no shade. There's zero shade for 21 miles. I mean, there's a couple. There's no real gas stations that are really open. You come into $1 General. The Dollar General actually knows about the race and will let you sit in their break room.
Nice. Awesome.
But yeah, so no, I used the umbrella when I could. I actually got so delirious though. I was using the umbrella, but then every time I would come into my crew, I wouldn't have it over me and I'd have it up. And that way you do it. And I was like, I don't know. When I got really bad going into War Trace, Tennessee. Funny story was, I went into War Trace and somebody called the police on me. Oh. And somebody said, there's either somebody who's drunk or delirious stumbling around downtown. Jeez. So a cop pulled up. He's like, we got a call. I was like, yeah. He's like, well, somebody's drunk or delirious. I said, that's me. He's like, he knew about the race. He says, okay. You in that walk? I said, yeah. He goes, You stumbling around. I said, well, you know, 200 and something pounds. I step off a curb. I said, I'm tired. He goes, yep, I can see that, and drove off. So basically, the cop called me fat and left. And but it was cool, you know. So I was very delirious at points, but in control if you've been there before.
Man, that's incredible. So you get through the meat grinder. And what does that leave you with? How much to go?
Just about there. It drops into like near Kimball. So from there, I dropped it. I probably had 30 miles left.
Wow. And how were the last 30 miles?
Good and bad. So I got in. We do a big drop into the town before Kimball. And it's like a 3 mile drop. And it's, you know, your quads are killing you. And there's, once again, no shoulder. I'm talking 6 inches of a rumble strip is what you're working with, and cars coming at you. And I did that in the daytime. So there was a lot of traffic coming at me. The one saving grace was I did it on the weekend. So I wasn't dealing with rush hour or anything, but I dealt with a lot of cars. So you're kind of hugging rocks as you're going down. So what I would try to do is run. When I saw cars coming, I would hug the rock, then keep running. Basically, Laz has never saw a road he didn't think was okay to run down. So I got down there and I was really hot, really tired. There was a road angel. We sat and talked to him for a few minutes. And then I moved on into Kimball. Now, where it became good is at this point, people kind of were adopting me and, you know, kind of keeping up with me on social media. And I got to Kimball and there were a lot of people at the hotel. At the hotel, you have 14 miles left. And they were there to cheer me on. So I stopped in Kimball, went ahead and got my room from when after the race, and made the final push to Sand Mountain. So you go from Kimball, you cross the bridge at South Pittsburgh, the Big Blue Bridge, which is kind of iconic. Hold on 1 second, Aaron.
Okay. Yeah. But sure, the rest of y'all didn't have a roll hanger. I've seen a roll hanger right there in the floor. Oh.
All right. Sorry.
All good.
I had 14 miles left. I made the push there. And then at the point when you hit Sand Mountain is a 3 mile climb again. And you've got 6 miles left in the race. And so you basically, you do a 3 mile push up the mountain. Then it's like 3 miles of cornfield and trail, and you're at the rock.
Man, that's awesome. So how far out can you see the rock?
How far can you see from the rock, or how far?
So when you're approaching it from
last second, you pop out of the cornfield and these woods, and then there they are. And Laz does the thing where he's like, one more mile to go, and then you hit another sign. No, now just one more mile. Then another sign. No, just really, and what he's done is he's put the signs 0.3 miles apart. But you're so delirious and you're moving so slow, you think you've gone a mile each time.
Oh, yeah.
So it's just kind of one last joke and one last kind of like, I hate these people. And you get to the end and they walk you out to the rock. They take your picture. And I hit it at night, so you couldn't see a lot off of it. But then they sit you down and you get to talk to Laz. So, he does this thing where he asks you if it hurt as bad as you thought it was going to do, and then basically gets your overall feelings about the race, and it kind of, grants you your 10 minutes with him to kind of talk back and forth. And I honestly don't remember a lot of the conversation because I was so out of it, but I remember, him kind of being what I felt was proud of me, because before the race, he asked me if I'd ever done any of his races, and I told him I'd done Strolling Jim, the 40-miler. And then I told him I DNF'd it, did not finish. And he looked at me and goes, well, it's not looking good for you then, because Strolling Jim has a 95% completion rate, and I don't see you doing well in this. And so that was kind of that push. I got to the end, I was like, you remember what you said? And he was like, I got to build you up. So.
Yeah. Oh man, that's awesome.
Proud moment.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge congratulations. That's amazing. I mean, that you think about what percentage of people are ever going to do that race, and it's incredible, to have the finish and already be thinking about next year. That's awesome.
I've already signed up as long as I make it in through the lottery, but if I don't, I'm sure I'll make it in through the wait list. I mean, it happens every year. So. No, next year, the goal is under 8 days. So I want it to start with a 7.
And do it screwed, right?
Yeah, and do it screwed. No, there's just no reason I should. I think without my shin acting up, I think I would have finished in the 8s, like the high 8 day. I would have came in under 9 days. And I think with a little more fitness under me, I think 7 days is definitely possible, 7 days and change.
That's tremendous. I hope some people pulled some stuff away from this conversation, because there's a lot there. You brought a lot to the table on this one. That was tremendous, both in your attitude and in what you were doing and how you did it. So, tremendous job, Hunt. That was, I was so proud of you when I saw that post.
Oh, just, man.
Yeah, no, it's, it's so cool. Absolutely so cool. Your journey to this, it's been brief, but you've done a tremendous amount in such a short amount of time. So cool. And I think you can give a lot of hope and inspiration to a lot of folks, because your journey from 330 to now, it's you're doing amazing things, dude. So thank you.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
Yeah. Any final words that you want to impart to folks?
Yeah, basically, if you want to do something, do it. Don't ever – I've got a saying is, what if has killed a lot of great adventures. Don't worry about it. By all means, train smart. Look for that avenue, whether it be with a coach or a training plan. I suggest a coach. But look for that consistency. Put in the work, but you know, don't worry about the outcome so much as take time, live the adventure, and push yourself to a limit. If you dreamed about doing something and you had the opportunity, go ahead and roll those dice and take that chance.
Well said. Where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, so Big Boys Trail and Try at Instagram. And on Facebook, if you'd like to hit me up, it's Hunt Brumby at Facebook. By all means, if I see you're a runner, I'm going to accept you. If you have any questions about Ball State or any other race, I'm happy to answer for you.
Yeah, you can definitely check out Hunt's results on Ultra Sign Up. He's done a smothering, that's for sure.
If you would like to live in the 40-something percentile on Ultra Sign Up, I am your man.
Oh, man. I've really enjoyed our conversation, Hunt. And again, I'm super proud of you, dude. Tremendous job.
Thank you. And thank you for putting in the work with me. That means a lot.
Absolutely, man. I love you.
I love you too, man.